Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 12th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum. And we have our panel of experts ready to field your scientific inquiries. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But that number is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. Your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Time to reconvene the Science Forum. The experts are here. They're very excited. They're not showing it, but they're very excited. The number to call is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 1-800-348-2551. Tweet them if you wish, at WAMC Vox Pop, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Easiest way to talk to an expert is to call, though, 800-348-2551. And as soon as we find an expert, we'll bring that person in the studio. No, actually, we have great scientists here today. And let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Oh, Ed Stander. I'm a geologist and astronomer and environmental scientist from SUNY Cobleskill. I cover everything from the center of the Earth to the edges of space. And really, I do everything that these two other people think they can do.
And who are the other two?
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Hi. Welcome.
He's retired.
Right.
Hey, and I'm Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist teaching also at SUNY Cobleskill, although right now I am here.
How are the things at Cobleskill going?
We are in our third week. Yeehaw!
Having fun?
I just handed a test back this morning, and there are people who actually cheered.
Really?
They thought they did much worse than they did.
Are the kids very bright this year and eager?
Last night, the average on the exam was a 77. So, boink, right at a C+.
Okay. All right. Well, let's curve them up a little bit, right?
We don't curve.
Okay. We don't curve.
Good for you. Good for you. All right. I have a question. My 9-year-old and I were hanging out. She borrowed our next-door neighbor's magnifying glass, big magnifying glass. And we noticed that when she was looking at me, as she held it close to her eye, everything was correct. And as she further and further went away, it flipped. What is the mechanism that caused that?
Optics.
Optics is the way the light is bent from the curvature of the glass and the lens. And there will be places where the image will be vertical and places where the image will be flipped over. And that's just because of the way the light. Imagine the light rays coming in and the top and bottom of the lens.
Mm-hmm.
And they are bent in toward each other.
Yeah.
So they will focus to a point at some point and then they will go apart.
Oh. It's called diverging.
Yeah, diverging.
Everybody is be crossing their yes. hands.
Well, it's radio, so yes. We're thinking of how to do this on the radio.
We're doing it right in front of the microphone so that everyone can hear my fingers.
All right.
So if you recall, the old-fashioned box cameras that people would put under the shroud and they take the photo, when they would look, the image would actually be inverted because it was on the other side of that focal length that they were seeing the image.
I never actually did that, but I will take your word for it.
Oh, I'll bring in my camera. You
really?
Can take a look.
No,
yeah.
You don't need to do that.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you had some homework, Barbara, that you want to discuss.
Oh, boy. Okay. So my homework, we had a caller. I'm sorry I didn't write down the caller's name. And they had seen a recent claim in the regular news cycle that time travel had been accomplished with two photons, so that's two bits of light, that were quantumly entangled.
Right.
Ugh, so trying to do this on the air is harder than trying to explain focal length. But I'll do my darndest.
Okay.
And I apologize to those quantums out there that think that I'm wrong.
Okay.
If you have two small things, and we'll call them pieces of light that are weightless, they do have, even if they're separated by large distances at any one set time, so like now, if I do something to one of them, if they are entangled, the other one will take up the opposite form. So think of them as like right-handed and left-handed.
Yeah.
They don't really have a handedness, but once I observe one and I see that it's right-handed, then the other one, which is all on the other side of the universe, has got to be left-handed. They can't both be the same type. That's just a rule of quantum particles.
Why does that happen?
We don't
it's
know.
It's a rule.
It's a rule.
That's all you know.
Follow the rules.
Don't question the rules.
Yes.
Understood.
So now we take time. And what we do is we have a series of cascading photon reactions. So we take one photon and we don't look at it. And we have it birth, move into something, get absorbed. That new substance then puts out more light, like you would have in the fluorescent light.
Yeah.
So photon number two is born. Photon number two gets absorbed by a substance. And then three and four come out of the second substance that photon two hit.
All right.
If you observe, quote, photon four, it makes photon three be the opposite and therefore determines back in time what photon two must have been and ultimately what photon one must have been. So it's kind of like saying I birthed two babies and they're going to be twins, so I'm going to have Tweedledee and Tweedledum, but that means they had to have a mother who could have twins, and that mother had to have a mother.
Right.
So by observing photons three and four, we can make what happened to photon one and two change their type.
Is this going to be on the test?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying.
It gets better than this as well, you understand, because until we observe it, we have no idea what's actually going to happen to the other one.
And the problem in quantum is the act of observing it, because there's such small pieces of energy and matter, actually changes what they are. So it's like you look to see if the refrigerator light goes on when the door is closed.
Yeah.
But you by looking at it, you change what the refrigerator light does. That's how the quantum
world
works.
But the meatloaf sandwich is still going to be there.
Not in the quantum world.
Well, I see that's right.
It might have been birthed by the other photon.
It may be there or it may not be there.
Quantum meatloaf sandwiches.
Oh,
now we
delicious.
Got something here.
Very low calorie.
Very low calorie, exactly.
But an important thing to keep in mind about all this is that you cannot communicate information that way.
Right.
So
why?
We don't
it's a
know
rule.
Yet.
Okay, it's another rule.
It's another rule.
Okay.
Because it is a fundamental rule. You can't communicate information faster than the speed of light.
Right.
So although these weird quantum interactions may occur, there's no way that...
But isn't that information in itself?
No.
No?
There's no way that I can send...
You can't modulate it.
...you a message using faster than the speed of light, using that kind of mechanism.
Okay.
Because then you wouldn't be a photon.
Right. So what it comes down to is the way that quantum mechanics is interpreted.
Yeah.
This is all in what's called the Copenhagen interpretation.
Right.
It goes back to Niels Bohr. There are other ways that quantum mechanics can be interpreted too, and that causes physicists to throw stones at each other.
Right, and string theory is part of this too.
Yeah.
And if you put two physicists in a room that's dark and you turn the light on, then one of the
one
other
of them's right-handed
will be
and one's left-handed.
Correct.
Okay, you know, I've had enough of this.
Yeah,
let's go
please.
To the phones. 800-348-2551.
Thanks for the question, caller.
1-800-348-2551. Elliot in Lenox, can you help us out here? Go ahead.
Yes, I had a question. I have a face cloth that I will put into my dishwasher, into the washer with detergent. It comes out. It's very flexible. If I use it without just with water on my face and it dries out, it's stiff. What's happening there? Why is the water? There's got to be something in the water that's affecting the pliability of this face cloth, and I wonder what it is.
It's chemistry. So you said it was terry cloth?
It's
yeah. Cotton? So terry cloth,
cotton.
Right, terry cloth is cotton, and it's a weave that has large loops in it, so it really will hold water, a lot of water. So even when it comes out of a washing machine, it's still wet. Those cellulose fibers, which is what cotton is made out of, they are they interact with each other with hydrogen bonds, with the water hydrogen bonding to the outside of the cellulose. And this creates a very regular pattern at the molecular level of how it's organized. If you let it sit in the sun or put it over the railing to dry, you drive a lot of those waters of hydration off. And then what happens is the cellulosic pieces, the wood fibers, if you will, interact, and that's the stiffness of the wood fibers because the water has been driven off, and you'd have to really break those fibers down in order to get the stiffness gone or rehydrate it with more water, and then it will reassemble with new hydrogen bonds.
And, of course, you can see
this. I get it. So it doesn't have anything to do with what's in the water. It's just what you said.
A little bit. There are some stiffeners that are put into detergents so that your clothes don't wrinkle as much.
Huh.
That's one of the components of modern-day laundry detergent. If you were to use dish soap, which don't use it in the washing machine, of course, but if you wanted to do your own little experiment at home, you could see how much of your detergent is influencing the structure, how stiff it is, versus just plain water versus the Dawn dish soap, for example, which has very little.
Yeah, and it's and it comes out soft out of the dryer because it's been tumbled around. And those fibers
are broken.
Yeah. Right. And if you want to, you don't even have to put any soap on it. Just wet it down and see what happens.
Right. And just if you wash without detergent, it's less disruption, so it'll actually be a little less stiff.
Right.
Okay.
I see. Okay.
Well, Elliot, thanks a lot for the call. Let's take a break here. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Brabets is here, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. A couple of quick emails here, and then we'll jump back on the phones. This one's from Matt in Saratoga. Matt writes, "My daughter, age 10, is fascinated by the ideas of quantum mechanics that my father taught her, basic ideas of uncertainty, Schrodinger's cat, etc. I'd love to encourage this interest. She's a voracious reader. Are there any books that might be comprehensible to her? She's in grade 5, but can probably understand books aimed at those slightly older than that. I'd even take a grown-up book that aims to explain quantum mechanics at a non-scientist level."
I would recommend any of the kind of young adult books that are quantum-driven, like This Strange Quantum World and You. Amazon gives it, I just checked, a 4 out of 5 rating. That's not my rating.
It might
rating,
be one person.
It might be Ed saying,
"I really like this one."
Author and his friends.
No.
But it's very popular, and I think it's a place to start. The book that I liked the best was In Search of Schrodinger's Cat.
Mm.
And that one's really aimed at adults, but if she's really up to snuff on the basic ideas of quantum assignment and how the quantum world differs from the classical world, it gives a little bit of history, and then it also talks about the weirdness of quantum.
All right, this email came in from...
Before you do, I just want to mention that if you do get a book on quantum mechanics, just by opening in that book, you're going to change the quantum world.
The pages change.
Not only the pages change, but the ideas of quantum physicists change almost as quickly.
So you're skeptical to some extent?
I'm not skeptical. No, I'm sure it's there. It's just I can't see it.
All right. This one's from Nikki in Wilmington, and I won't say Nikki's last name, but Nikki, you have a great radio name. You might want to consider that. Nikki writes, "When I try to tune my radio and I'm standing close to it, the reception is great. As soon as I step away, the reception gets worse. Why and what can be done about it?"
Well, why don't you take that one yourself here?
Well, I'm just reading.
Oh,
yeah, you know the answer.
You're adding inductance?
You're a human antenna.
Right.
Right.
You're full of water and metal.
Okay.
You work really well as an antenna. Drink more water, get better signal.
Okay. And
wear copper shoes.
Ooh.
Really?
Yeah.
Copper shoes?
Yeah, because you want to make a better ground if you can.
You know, I lived downstate for a while, and one area had great HF reception, and I believe there was a lot of iron deposits in the ground. Would that affect it?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
Well, there you go, Nikki, and good luck with that radio career. The number is 800-348-2551. Now let's go to Jay in Worthington. Jay.
Yes, this goes to your previous email. I have a child who's 16 years old who started eating Einstein when he was, I don't know, 5. And I thought he was looking at the pictures. And then he explained the theory of relativity to me once, driving to school when he was about 8. You know, I'd encourage any parent, just get them any book and don't worry about whether it's age appropriate. It encourages their imagination. But my question is, could you just talk in general terms about post-high school education? My son's very concerned about where he goes to school. Will it limit his possibilities? I don't think so. You don't have to go to Caltech or MIT. There are lots of good schools out there. So could you please talk about that?
Okay. You're talking to two academics and a PhD, so we're good.
And a radio guy.
And a radio guy. Okay. The big question is, where does your son, what is his field of interest? Is it engineering? Is that what you're saying?
It's cosmology, quantum mechanics. I mean, he's really keen. I mean, he talks about this all the time. So, he has equations written on the wall in his room and Sharpie. I don't know what he's thinking, but all encourages imagination.
Is the right time to really start.
He wants to go to Mars.
Okay. Well, he's got to start by...
We don't have any branches of SUNY at Mars
yet. He's got to stop writing on the wall in Sharpie. That's the first thing he's got to do.
It's okay. We peeled the wallpaper off. He's welcome to do it, everyone. I'll cover it up sometime.
That whiteboard paint goes a long way. Yeah. Let me talk about it as a preparation for college. As far as selections go, there are lots of guides out there to tell you what the reputations of places are. Reputation has some effect, but reputations are often delayed. So they go around and they ask like CEOs and 50-year-olds, which colleges do you think that are best? And they're 30 years out of college. So often their advice is not necessarily the most current, but like U.S. News and World Report, that's a reputation guide, again, asked by people who are well out of school. if his high school performance is fine, then he really can write his ticket. There are tons of science and engineering jobs out there in this economy. It really has to do with what he's looking into and how creative he wants to be in crafting a job. A lot of Gen Zers these days are not working for a company, but rather they're piecemealing their expertise out to companies and doing it that way so they have more flexibility.
Well, he's mostly interested in education at this point. Not so much thinking. I mean, I have my stepsister's son just finished his PhD at University of Texas in Austin and in chaos theory and quantum computing. And he's looking for a job in quantum computing. And he and Eamon have, exchanged emails for some time. And Eamon reads his articles and comments on them and clearly understands them. So anyway, I'm just trying to allay my son's anxiety over where he goes to school next.
Yeah,
go on.
Yeah, I think especially if ultimately he wants to go to graduate school, and sounds like maybe he would, then the choice of the undergraduate school...
Less important.
I mean, you want to go to a good school, but a lot of places you can do very well and then get into a good graduate school.
All right. And speaking of that, Jay, we do have to move on. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Jerry in Lenox. Jerry, you're on.
How are you doing? My question is regarding the hurricane last week, Dorian. Most hurricanes, when they hit an island, they blast through it and then move on to the mainland and then grind up the coast. This one seemed to stall over the Bahamas, and I was wondering what caused that. Is it whatever it is?
Well, basically, it was a storm coming in the other direction, coming from the west to the east, so that you had a high coming into the side. So as it's coming in, it's facing headwinds effectively, and that's what causes it to take a tour to the north. So it really depends on what the other weather conditions in the area are in order to predict what these things do and when they're going to do it.
Right, the train of tropical...
More to the point of, why did it stay in the Bahamas as long as it did? And then when it started moving, steadily.
Right. It was one of the slowest moving hurricanes in a long, long time.
Right. There was what is called a trough of high pressure that was over the southeast United States. And then there was another high that was over the Midwestern Valley, the Midwest. And low pressure, like hurricanes, move in a counterclockwise direction. High pressure moves in a clockwise direction. So it was in opposition to what was pushing on it. And that was, it's like blowing a ball up in the air, like a ping pong ball. If you push enough, the ping pong ball won't hit the ground. The west to east current, as Ed was saying, was enough to keep it pushing, but it still had momentum also moving west. And so it didn't push it backwards, although some of the models had it moving east. Mm-hmm. And then eventually what happened is the two high pressures met together and created one clockwise rotation, and it moved out to the big high pressure moved out to the middle of the ocean, and that gave it a pinball right up the coast. That's why it started moving super fast.
Yeah, I think
you thank you very much.
Yeah, you had Les Goff on last week.
Who was Jason Goff was on a week or two ago.
And he was saying how basically the hurricanes don't move themselves. They're pushed along by
the weather conditions.
By the weather conditions around them.
And he was explaining the Long Island Express, which was what, maybe in the 30s. The storm was moving at, and I forget the actual numbers, he said 60 or 65 miles an hour, with the winds of 100+ in the storm itself. So, people were not ready for that.
Yeah, it's very much like playing a game of foosball, where it's the winds underneath the foosball table that keeps the ball from moving. Not as foosball,
your air hockey.
Air hockey. It's the winds underneath that keep it going the direction it's going. So you give it a little tap, it's going to go.
Back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Bill in Ashfield. Bill, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. My question has to do with water and surface tension. If you have a very slow leak in a faucet, you get a drop every so often. What is the mechanism that tells the water drop when to let loose and fall?
Okay.
Gravity.
Yeah. When the force of
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. When the force of gravity becomes greater than the forces of surface tension that are holding it on.
Meaning that the drop itself reached a certain critical weight.
Yes.
So if it's light, then the force of gravity isn't as great as the surface tension is to repel it.
Yeah. So
if you are at a very high altitude, would the size of the drop of water be different than if you were at sea level?
Not really.
We're talking about hundreds. Yeah, as far as the difference goes, you mean from like the vapor pressure?
In terms of the strength of the gravity.
No.
Oh, you got to go quite a long way away. Before.
Like maybe the moon.
Okay.
Yeah, if you were to do this, for example, on a spaceship and on your way to the moon where there's zero gravity, the drop would effectively not form until it got large enough to break off. Then it would just sit there.
In fact, on the ISS, when they are International Space Station, when they're in microgravity in that constant free fall, you can see their droplets just stay as large globular droplets and aren't really made into a teardrop at all by the microgravity that they're in.
There was an amazing picture I saw today. I think it was space.com of a flame that an experiment.
Flame in space is cool. Yeah. It does not look anything like it normally
looks.
It
almost like a galaxy.
Yeah.
Let's see, who's been waiting the longest here? 800-348-2551. Marvin in Rhinebeck. Hello, Marvin in Rhinebeck.
Hey, how are you doing, gentlemen? How are you doing?
Hi, Marvin.
Now, I have an old Philco black and white television in my living room.
Right.
And above the television, I have an old style antenna, the one that you can move around.
Yes.
I put tinfoil on the antenna arms of the antenna, and every time I turn it to the north, I seem to get the Eddie Cantor
really
singing "If You Knew Susie Like I Know Susie." Right. oh what a girl. Now I'm going to hang up and hear my answer on the radio. Thank you, and God bless all.
Marvin, always good to hear from you. Well, what do you think, Eddie Cantor?
I'm happy his Philco still works. That's great.
Maybe that's an example of quantum time travel. I don't know.
Yeah, Susie needs some help.
I think he might be picking some things up on the old tinfoil. Good job there, Marvin. Thank you for the call. Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Why does the volume on my one radio increase dramatically after it's been on for a while?
Maybe you ought to talk to Marvin.
Yeah, is it a... tube radio or a regular radio?
Not really sure. It's probably about 20 years old now.
Oh, it's not, it's a regular tube radio.
Right. So it's a transistor radio. What's probably happening is that some of the components inside are heating up, and as they heat up, the resistance decreases. And whatever that thing is inside there that's doing that is probably causing the volume to get louder by itself. It's probably not the signal that's getting louder. It's probably just a part of the volume control that's doing that. That would be my guess.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, and it's the Science Forum, a varied selection of questions today on the program. Francis in Williamstown. Francis, you're on.
Thank you. It seems to me that light is moving in all directions simultaneously, and I'm wondering why light does not interfere with itself.
It does.
It does.
It sure can.
Yeah, I mean, light. So if you have a point source of light, let's say a candle, then yeah, it's radiating in all directions. If you have a laser, it's just coming out in one direction. And it certainly does interfere with itself.
Well, let me put it this way. If I were to put up a series of mirrors and were, let's just say, in a circle, and I were to turn and look at the mirrors, they would each be reflecting something different, slightly different as I looked around the circle. But they would be doing that reflection at all times simultaneously. But the light is not interfering with itself the way, for example, a radio wave might interfere with another radio wave.
Yes, it does.
It does. You just can't see it with your naked eye.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
What would it require to see that interference?
Oh, even if you looked at an IR camera, you can rent those sometimes at your best home stores in order to look for energy efficiency. They often come with a screen. And you can see some of the interference that exists right around the image of the IR image on the screen. It looks fuzzy.
So if I were to set up a mirror down at the corner of the street pointing left and another mirror pointing right, I would be able to see around the corner, and the people around the corner would be able to look in the mirror and see me looking down the alleyway. But the light would the interference of the light would not be sufficient for any of us to notice it?
Well, don't confuse the optical effects of mirrors reflecting stuff with the interference of light
waves. Rays, right.
Light waves. That's kind of a different phenomena.
Hmm. All right. I'll let the answer stay there, but I'm still not quite so clear. Anyway. Thank you for that.
Hey, thanks a lot, Francis. Our number is 800-348-2551. Zach, the engineer, you got the Eddie Cam. Lovely Eddie Cantor. Thank you for that music. It's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Science Forum today, Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Jim Pickett here, and your humble host, Ray Graff. This one came in from Mark. Mark writes, "Hello, science panel. TV shows like Star Trek are obviously fantasy, but do you think humans traveling at warp speed or any of the technology portrayed on Star Trek will ever become real someday?"
Well, I am staring at my cell phone, which looks a lot like a communicator.
Yep.
And they even make a beep, beep, beep that you can get for it.
Sure.
As your text alarm. So it even sounds like Kirk's communicator.
And a couple of years ago, they came up with somebody was offering $1 million for the first person who could come up with a tricorder.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They came darn close. They couldn't do blood work, but they could do just about everything else.
Yeah, warp speed, though, is going to be a little more of a challenge.
Notice we dodged that one,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet on warp
However,
speed.
We were watching it the other day, and one of the things I noticed was All the flat screen monitors. I mean, they were all over the place on that show. So that was
well,
30
and
years ahead of time.
If you can dimly recollect floppy disks,
yeah,
the 3.5-inch floppy that came about after the 5.25 was fashioned after the 3.5-inch floppies that Kirk and Spock were putting into the computer when they needed to move information from one place to another.
I'll be darned. So. All right, back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. Bob in Pine Bush. Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm curious about gold. Does it only form in the core of the earth and the molten lava and the gases and then pushed up to the surface, or was it deposited by meteorites?
Well, the gold that's on the surface of the earth probably formed in a star that blew up many, 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 many moons ago. And as a result, those gold atoms were already around. And when the Earth formed, they wound up on the Earth. They don't form in the core. If they do form in the core, we don't have any evidence of that. The pressures and temperatures are enough to keep iron and nickel going, but gold is a whole nother thing. So the stuff that we find on the surface in the crust, for the most part, formed from the original melt of the planet and wound up in the surface.
And then it coalesces because it's very dense, and so it kind of everything with the same density goes to where it's supposed to go and kind of sticks there.
Now, on the subject of why gold actually shows up like that, it turns out that when you form a lava, there will be a certain number of gold atoms in there, and gold is one of the last things that crystallizes out of a lava, along with quartz. Which is the reason why, for example, if you're looking for gold veins, you look for quartz veins first, because this is the stuff that comes out of the lava as the sort of the last fractionation and will show up together in the same spot.
I'll be darned. Now, iridium, that came from an asteroid impact?
Supposedly. The iridium is pretty rare on the Earth, and it does show up more so in meteorites.
So what we've been able to tell by looking at light from coming from other planets or other solar systems is that their iridium concentration is not as high as our iridium concentration. So that's why we think we're spiked with a little bit more.
And it's all in one layer, right?
Not quite all in one layer.
Well, the iridium that's mined isn't meteorite iridium. I mean, it's same thing like gold. I mean, it was originally part of the stuff that the Earth coalesced.
And it comes in all the time. But that one layer you're talking about was between the Cretaceous and the Tertiary, and that appears to have been formed by a meteor impact, which then spread this iridium in a very concentrated layer around the Earth.
Yeah. Our number here is 800-348-2551, the Science Forum, and Chris in New Paltz. Chris, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. And to be honest, I'm not sure if this question is going to even be allowed. So if it's not, I understand.
All right.
I am particularly horrified by the news that the executive branch of the government has been directing the NOAA to contradict the findings of the National Weather Service and to ask three eminent scientists how they feel about this. And what can we as citizens do to sort of restore the respect that science deserves? I think that there's been a great disrespect of science for
a number
of years now from this administration, and I'm just curious to see how you guys feel about it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not a science question, but let's let our scientists weigh in real quickly here on this.
Okay, I'll start. I think the biggest disservice we do to science is treat it as rejectable. So whether that's a president or whether that's a family living on in a coastal community that has a chance for flooding and they're like, well, maybe it won't happen to us. We can't predict the future, but we can give possibilities and probabilities. And we look for patterns and then make it known what those patterns are and what is the extrapolation of the pattern for the future. I mean, that's what geology does. Ed can't even go and design an experiment. He has to look at these crappy experiments that were done 300 million years ago and say, oh, look what they did. And, you know, that was the planet. And then, boom, this is what we get.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that's the biggest thing that we could do. Whether it's a president or a private citizen, there are differences in impact because of policy. But I'm just going to leave it that if, you know, disinfection by airing of information is probably the best way to root out falsehoods within science. And that includes even our own literature.
Yeah, I'd like to add that one of the biggest and most important things that science ever came up with is the error bar. And that's the idea that there is a certain possibility that what we're saying may not be true.
Yeah.
And as a result, people who work in science understand that, but people in the political world very often don't. And so they look at these things and say, this is truth, this is not
right.
truth. But that's not how science works. And it becomes very, very important to understand that if you're going to try and keep science on the right level.
When Ed or I or Jim say error, we don't think bad, like slap the hand, go sit in the corner. We understand that that is just a part of something that is, and it doesn't have that negative connotation to us.
Yeah. And I think it's a matter of taking science as it's our best shot. And if you're going to make a bet, you should bet on what the science says. It might not always be right,
yeah,
but it's our best shot.
Is there a cover charge at the error bar?
It depends on what you're having.
I see a meme. You know, that is a great one.
That's good.
Greg in East Meredith. Greg, you're on.
Hello. Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi.
Great show. I love the science show. I heard last night listening to public radio about an exoplanet that they discovered 100 light years away that has liquid water. And it was really
Maybe.
Exciting because it's really the first exoplanet like that. And I was wondering, is there any kind of, like, how do they even do that and figure that out? Is there any kind of, like, spectral signature of light that they could actually find? Like, somehow they know that there's a certain ratio of carbon and hydrogen and that, therefore, there's probably something alive there. There's some organic material. Is there any way they could do that at such a distance?
Methane?
Absolutely.
Sure.
That's how that's done.
Even on asteroids, when they're flying by, we take a spectral signature to look for certain hydrocarbons, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen molecules that are particular to amino acids, because we know that that is one of the building blocks of biological life, at least in our neck of the woods. And we have found amino acids existing. The Japanese just went and landed on one and blew it up and then took pieces and looked at them and found intact amino acids that we recognize.
And we found it on meteorites as well, such as the Murchison meteorite.
Right.
This exoplanet, however, is far away. They're just beginning to figure this out. But what they understand is there may or may not be any surface to this at all. Mm-hmm. There are conditions where it might be similar to Earth-like conditions, but they're way up. It's mostly hydrogen, from what I understand. The pressure would just crush anything the further down you go.
Yeah, it was the detection of water vapor in the atmosphere,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
Yeah, so it's not a matter of detection of liquid water in the Earth. And with the spectra for molecules like that, looking into what's called the infrared part of the spectrum, so longer wavelengths than red, provides a lot of information as to the kinds of chemical bonds that are present.
It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Rabbits, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett here, and Patrick is in Utica. Patrick, you're on.
Hi. I want to build on some of the earlier questions about the nature of light.
Okay.
Sure. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm in a car. Sorry about that.
Right.
The question and comments. The comment is the earlier caller asked about light interfering with itself, and I think that's called a laser interferometer is able to detect that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the 2014 Cosmos update had an episode that dealt with that specifically about Faraday discovering how light would interfere with itself. And my question is related to that. Since light is an electromagnetic phenomena, why don't we see magnets, or at least strong magnets or electromagnets, why don't we see it bending light around the edges or doing funny things or interacting strangely with light?
Because the magnet is only half of light. Light is modulation both in a magnetic field and in an electric field. And you have... But... See, light will diffract around any object. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's there.
magnets and metals and electromagnetic fields interact with each other. We don't, like, for example, a solenoid works, and that's a magnet and electromagnetic field. And light is
field. Well, it's The electromagnetic field on light is different from it's different from an electromagnet.
Okay.
I can't explain it more than
Well, one is mass, one has mass.
Yeah.
And charge, and can be influenced by other things with mass and charge. And photons, to this day, we still think they're massless, so they behave slightly differently than those massed objects, even though they're all quantum particles.
Well, Patrick, thank you for the call, and let's now go to Tom in Albany. Tom, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad. I own an old Fender Stratocaster guitar.
Nice.
And it's got single coil pickups in it. But I've also owned Gibson Les Pauls that have dual humbucker pickups. And I was hoping to get you guys talking about the difference between single coil versus humbucker pickups.
Okay, well, let's talk about how the humbucker actually bucks the hum. And so be careful the way you say it.
I'd love to hear you guys talk about it, but thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Yeah, I'm bowing out. I played piano.
I'll bet
don't
you
know
Ed
guitar.
Knows the answer to
Ed
this
knows
one.
The answer.
I'd actually have to take it for homework.
Okay.
Because I've worked with humbuckers, but I've never actually taken one apart and taken a look.
Isn't it sort of a phase cancellation thing?
I believe it is.
But it,
I'm not
it
really
must be
sure.
Offset. Otherwise, you'd just be air guitaring it the whole time.
Because you can get a single coil guitar that has phase switch and basically play one single coil against another and turn them into what is essentially a humbucker.
I think the real question is, what hum are you bucking?
I mean, maybe Marvin will call again. I'm sure it's Eddie Cantor.
If we're talking about a 60-cycle hum, then that's a whole different story. That's what I have to look into.
Okay. Oh, you're thinking of which fundamental is it?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is your homework
that's
for the next show.
That's my homework for next time.
Very good.
That's a promise.
Why don't you bring a Strat and a Les Paul, and we'll crank it up.
I've got the Strat,
I got a Univox High Flyer at home. We could probably.
Do you really?
Yeah, sure.
Right, let's not do any of those things. Jim in Lake Katrine. Jim, you're on. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
People.
Hi.
Hi. How why is it that we can't, say, have five airplanes flying around the eddying winds of the hurricane and dropping, say, 5-ton bombs? Time to go up simultaneously in the airflow, and wouldn't that stop the circular motion? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Is this Donald in Washington calling in? What do you think about that?
Boy, that would be a messy, messy place.
Well, the first problem is that you've got a hurricane. The hurricane is 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers in diameter. You're dropping a bomb in one small spot.
Right.
And that's not going to stop the winds. Even if you were to drop it in the center of it and try and break the walls of the hurricane, it would reform almost immediately.
Mm. Because it's being fed by the hot, warm water underneath it.
Right. And on top of that, if you were to drop a bomb, of course, it would have to be a very large bomb, of course, probably a hydrogen bomb or something like that. That would all go into the hurricane, and the next thing you'd know, you'd have radioactive material falling all over the place.
And you'd pick up some sharks, you'd have a Sharknado, atomic radiation
sharknado.
It's like
day after tomorrow equals plus Sharknado.
This, you know what, we have something. Now, we got a little focus group going. Russell in New Paltz. Russell, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I think my question is a somewhat metaphysical question.
Oh, splendid.
I've had this discussion with a friend about existence. It's my contention that existence contains everything that is. And his contention is, well, what about beyond existence? And I say, there really isn't a beyond. You know, existence is existence. A is A. And I think his answer is fueled by his religion that there's a supernatural dimension beyond existence, and we haven't been able to resolve this question.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we only have 2.5 minutes, so have at it, scientists.
Well, there's a question starting off right off the bat with dimensionality, and we have four dimensions that we can pretty well define, and we have particles that pop in and out of those four dimensions. And where they go when they're not in that fourth dimension or the third or the second or the first suggests that there may be other dimensions out there. Some people would argue there's as many as 11 or 12 dimensions.
Can you prove that, though? Is that scientifically falsifiable?
All we can do is look to see if it shows up somewhere else in what we can see.
Okay.
Right. So those things that happen and don't happen in our dimension, in our environment, could very easily be part of another dimension. And if they are part of another dimension, then there could be an enormous number of these, and it's impossible to say because we can't
define
them.
Aren't all those dimensions part of existence?
That totally depends on what you call existence and where you define the boundaries.
Yeah, whose existence is it?
Existence is everything that is.
So the universe.
But what does is mean? Does it mean it has to have matter? Does it have? Was it once alive? Was it going to be alive some
other
time? Where's the time dimension to existence?
Okay, yeah. I just think existence contains everything that is. All the things you were speaking about, all the dimensions you were speaking about.
Okay. Fine.
It contains everything.
Then what you're effectively saying is there's no limit to infinity. And that makes a perfectly viable argument. You can't argue against or for that.
Right. The infinity times infinity does not equal a larger number.
Except if you're in an argument at my house.
Or with his friend.
Well, thank you very much for that one. And we still have, aren't we lucky, about a minute and a half here. Scott in Western Mass. Scott, you're on.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. I was curious, as we go about more and more electronic drivers for things like light and radio, are we running to the limit of the number of frequencies available? I used to listen to AM radio, and now I can hardly get any.
I love that question. Are we polluting the spectrum?
Well,
we are polluting the spectrum.
And, it's getting crowded.
And as a result, the FCC keeps up coming up with variations of that spectrum. One of the main reasons we went for digital television was because that increases the amount of spectrum room that we have. But sooner or later, it's going to run out, and then we're going to be having a problem.
Well, I have a question of the panel. So the previous Marvin talked about Philco.
Yeah.
Are there any analog signals still being transmitted for TV?
Sure. Of course.
Oh, on TV?
Yeah. Would his Philco even receive anything that would be more than a static?
Only Marvin knows.
We got microwave.
You know what? We have been polluting the spectrum quite long enough. Some more comes from Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996. iMediaConsult.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services and deliveries, georgepropane.com. At Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated for over 50 years, offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice, hadleygardencenter.com. Well, thanks once again to Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here. Thank you for calling, even you, Marvin. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. Tomorrow on Food Friday, the team from the Holy Cross Armenian Church in Troy will join us as we explore Armenian cuisine. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.